Let's turn to the passage that we read in 2 Corinthians chapter 8. We're going to focus this morning really on the first nine verses of 2 Corinthians as we start a brand new series looking at God's perspective on the use of our money. We're doing well at the moment. We've done a series on sex, and now we're doing one on money. So you'll be glad to know. People say that churches don't talk about these things, but we do talk about these things here in our church. And to give us a link between the two, some of you may have noticed that yesterday was Valentine's Day. And I read a very interesting statistic in Time magazine that almost $700 million... are spent by Americans on Valentine's Day buying gifts for their pets. $700 million for gifts for pets on Valentine's Day. I also read another interesting statistic which said that one woman in five has to buy their own Valentine gift, which I think, men, we can do better than that, surely. Anyway, but that was a remarkable statistic. And it sort of demonstrates why we need to be engaging and talking about this issue. Because actually, the way that we use our resources is of fundamental and defining importance. Some of you will be aware that the gulf between the developed world and the developing world, rather than decreasing over the last 100 years, has actually increased. So those who lived in the developed world are actually getting richer, while those in the developing world are actually getting poorer. But when you begin to look at the developing world itself, we also find stark contrast, because there is greater social and material inequalities within the developing world. And we now discover that the richest 1% are increasingly wealthy, as opposed to the rest of those communities. And so the issue of how we use our money and wealth is a massive issue. We sort of nowadays have the politics of envy, which are increasingly a part of the political sphere that is demonstrated. We weekly carry issues. I think that there were a whole series of stories and tax avoidance and all sorts of things targeted in terms of questions about how we use our wealth and our resources. But $700 million on your pets suggests that this is something fundamental that we need to consider. There's a professor of wealth management and philanthropy in America, and he wrote a book called Wealth. He's called Paul Shervitzi. And he wrote a book called Wealth and the Will of God. And he says this. He talks about a condition called affluenza. And he says, for the foreseeable future, the quality of social and cultural life will be more than at any other time in history be linked to growth in material life, both publicly and personally, nationally and internationally. I expect that the leading intellectual, emotional, and behavioral issues of the day will revolve around the detriments, dilemmas, and dynamics of personal decisions making in an age of affluence. In other words, major intellectual, emotional, and behavioral energies are going to be dedicated to the way that we use our money. And this is going to actually be a defining feature of the 21st century. It's interesting the way that the wealth has become the defining element of who you are. And how people are now evaluated in terms of not their character, but actually their material status. And for us who are wealthy, and I know you all might be sitting here thinking, well, we're not really wealthy, but you actually are. Most of us have resources in one form or another that we are called to manage. This raises a whole bunch of questions for us. For instance, what does it mean to live generously? What does generosity look like? Should I give to everything and everyone? And in a 21st century culture where money has become, where we We can use social media to communicate about needs. We have media like TV and all sorts of things. We are inundated by requests for money, for the use of our resources. And the question is, should I give to everything and everyone? Should I just give to the things that social pressure builds up to give to? And then we have this other issue, which is, for Christians, quite a big issue, which is, if I spend money on myself, should I feel guilty? We often find that there comes this dilemma for many Christians about the way that they use their money. And Max Weber, who was a sociologist at the start of the 20th century, he wrote a book called the Protestant about the Protestant work ethic, and he suggested that Calvinism was actually at the root of capitalism. And basically, the idea was that you have to work hard, you have to make lots of money, but you can't spend any of that money on yourself, because God wouldn't like that, and so you have to reinvest it to make more money, and hence the capitalist system. That's a very simplistic analysis of Max Weber, but that's essentially what he was saying. And a lot of people are like that. They feel instantaneously guilty if you go and spend money on yourself. My wife's not here, so I can mention this, but my wife comes from the Western Isles, which has a sort of Presbyterian culture. And it's fascinating in terms of the differences that we have in relation to money. Actually, it's quite interesting as you begin to look at your own psychology in terms of how we feel and think about money. You find all sorts of disproportionate responses in terms of the mention of money. As I've said, some people feel guilty, feel vulnerable. I would, but I can't. Other people, because of the association with security and money, begin to feel very, very uncomfortable when we talk about giving money away and about generosity, especially in a church situation. And so you sometimes get the reaction, it's private. What I do with my money is nobody else's business. Or sometimes that then translates into any discussion or talk about money is seen as manipulative. So the idea is they're after my money. I believe that actually talking about money and our attitudes to money and thinking through, and all of us, have an actual attitude towards money, and you'd be surprised the diversity if we all began to talk about how we feel about money and the emotions that it generates in some of us. For some of us, it will make us feel guilty. Some of us, it will make us feel secure. Some of us will feel much more possessive with it. It'll be fascinating as you just look at your own psychology, which is based on your experiences and life experiences, how you feel and think about money. But learning to give in an appropriate way is part of discipleship. Learning to process and relate to money is part of what it means to follow Christ. And the key thing here, and we'll see this in 2 Corinthians, which provides us with extensive teaching on the whole area of giving, 2 Corinthians 8 and 9, probably the largest chunk in the whole of the New Testament on this theme, is that it says it isn't actually about what we do as how we feel, or actually what is occurring inside us. Because it says that discipleship and engagement with money is actually about an attitude of heart. And it's about cultivating the right attitude of heart. So some people have the attitude, we never have enough, and any attempt to spend any money always feels like profligate. Whereas others think life is for living and money is for spending. By the way, if those two people are married to each other, it makes for an interesting relationship. But Paul says it's actually all about what's going on inside your heart. It's about what's inside your head. It's about all of these things that have shaped your attitude towards money. And what he's saying is your relationship to God has to somehow work its way out in how you relate to material stuff round about you. And so in verse 8 of this chapter, he makes this declaration. He says, I'm not commanding you. He says, so I'm not standing here saying what you must do or not do in terms of money. What I am saying is that God is interested in our hearts. And it's actually about dealing with what is going on inside our hearts that is the concern of God. If someone, and if any of you within this church context feels manipulated, coerced, feels the notion of you ought to, and any of those senses, actually, Paul's saying that stuff is fundamentally wrong. He's actually saying that what has to happen before you develop a pattern and a response with your money is that you have to undergo heart surgery. You have to undergo an attitude transformation. I always say this, and it's because it's biblical. You see, there is never a resourcing issue in a church. There is a vision issue. And the reason that churches often do not have sufficient resources is not because there aren't resources there. It's because people don't have a vision. And because there is no vision, there is no desire. And because there is no desire, there is no resource. You know, I hate it, and I won't fall out with treasurers at this moment, but I hate it when people turn around and go, oh, we haven't got the money to do X or Y. You know, most of the time in churches, and I say this very advisedly, it's a lie. Of course we have money to do X and Y and Z. You just total the recreational spend of our congregations in 1 week. You know, and if we chose to do things differently, in fact, again, there was another interesting article, I think it was in one of the newspapers this week, which said that actually, if you gave up drinking coffee for the period of 20 years, you could afford a small mortgage. Just the amount that we spend on the incidental coffees that we buy in the course of our lives. And here Paul's saying the same sort of thing. He's saying if we have a real love for God and a real love for his church, then that will express itself in practical terms. And the issue is about our love for God and our love for his church. You know, I loved hearing about our youth work and the development. And the truth is, and again, I haven't got the stats here this morning, but if I showed you the stats about the age at which people get converted, about the patterns of unbelief in our society, those who are finding it more difficult to express a Christian faith, we would all instantaneously see that any church that plans to move into the future needs to be investing massively in young people. And it's brilliant to see, and if you come on Sunday evenings, you will see this, you know, a dozen or so young people coming along to our church services in the evenings from unchurched backgrounds because we're investing and we're working and we're engaging in the sphere. In fact, three of them have become Christians. And that's exciting in terms of the future of the church. But for me, it doesn't require any thinking. I think they say it's a no-brainer that you have to invest in reaching young people, and churches need to release resources to be doing that. And it's something in SBC that we have always done. But it doesn't take a lot of thought to see that. And I could sit here and wax eloquently about it, but you see, the reason that we should do that is not because, oh, well, there's a need here or there's a need there. Or, the reason we should do that is because we have a love for God and we have a love for his church and we believe in the future of that church. Here, Paul in 2 Corinthians 8 and 9 is addressing a very real issue that was taking place in the first century. What was occurring was there was a famine in Judea. And the church there was in severe need. They needed to buy food. They needed to buy grain. And it needed to be imported in order that people shouldn't starve to death. And they really were starving to death. And in Greece, which was divided into various provinces, Achaia in the south and Macedonia in the north, they had very prosperous churches in very wealthy cities. In fact, if you go to those places today, you'll see the cities with beautiful monuments and lovely streets. And Paul needed to get those churches to release some of their resources to the church in Judea so that the Christians could be fed. And there were some exceptionally wealthy guys in these churches, particularly in the church in Corinth that he is writing to. We actually have a reference to a man called Erastus. And Erastus was the city treasurer of the city of Corinth. This means he is one of the wealthiest guys in the entire empire. There's actually an inscription that was dug up in Corinth which says, Erastus laid this pavement at his own expense in appreciation of his appointment as city treasurer. And this was one of the guys in the congregation that Paul's speaking to. He'd probably want to take him out for a coffee and have a wee chat with him. But you see, Paul's saying, and as he approaches this wealthy church in Corinth, he says to them, look, guys, I'm not here to command you, but I want to hold up some examples for you to consider in terms of the patterns of giving that others have adopted. And hopefully these patterns will challenge you about your own attitudes and about what you are doing. And he holds up the example of the church in Macedonia, which was the church, if we go, which is the churches in the north. You see where it says Thessalonica and Philippi. Those were the churches in the north. And there was a kind of north-south thing. If they were playing rugby, didn't really play rugby, but if they were playing rugby, you know, the south always liked to beat the north and the north always liked to beat the south. Sounds like today. Anyway, and this was the way and the patterns that occurred. And so what he does is he takes the north and he says, look at the example of the north. Look at what they've done in Macedonia. And he lays out a pattern for giving. And you'll see this begins to develop. For I testify that in verse 3, for I testify that according to their ability and beyond their ability, they gave of their own accord, begging us with much entreaty for the favor of participation in the support of the saints. He lays out the pattern of Macedonia and he says, this is how they did it in Macedonia. First of all, they gave proportionately. That means that they gave according to what they had. Okay, now, this is really important. Giving should be proportionate. It should be a matter of looking at what your resources are and thinking what is an appropriate proportion of that to give to the work of God. Okay, so you've got to think, again, a lot of people don't do this. They don't sit down and think, what proportion or percentage of my resources am I going to allocate and give away? If I should be able to get every single person in this room and say, what proportion of your resources are you committed to giving away? You should be able to answer that question. I'm not going to tell you what proportion that should be. Just if you've got a lot, it should be a lot. If you haven't got a lot, well, it shouldn't be so much. But you should have in your head a proportion and a percentage, and you should know that, okay? If you haven't got a percentage in your head, then you need to get one, because giving should be proportionate. Giving is not about, oh, well, I see an appeal, I'll give away some money this week, or I don't feel I have so much, maybe I'll not give so much. Shouldn't be like that. Giving should be about having a clear thought out, this is the amount that I'm going to allocate and give away. And all of you should know that, okay? That's the first thing. Then the second thing is, it says, it is sacrificial. They went beyond their means. Again, what he's saying is that they not only determined the proportion, but on occasion, they were willing to give things up in order to release resources for God. Okay, here's another challenge for us. When was the last time that we actually had to give up something? One of the big concerns I have about SBC is that we live within our means. I know this makes Ron's heart glad, but it's one of my big concerns. Because actually, we never experience sacrificial giving. A couple of weeks ago, I was preaching in a church in Bishop Briggs that my father founded 40 years ago. And this is a true story. This church was made up of predominantly young married couples, and they decided to start building a Christian community and build a church in the middle of that community. And they didn't have a lot of money. But the church there and the young people began to give things up. We're about to enter Lent, so I don't know if you're giving up coffee or whatever, but they began to give things up instead of buying that new TV, instead of going on that holiday, they said, we're committed to seeing a church being built and developed here in this community. And they began to give that up. And the bank manager, and this is in the days when you had bank managers, and he knew the income of the people in this congregation, and he saw the receipts that were coming in terms of what that church was doing. And that bank manager got converted. That's a true story. He actually got converted. He's now still a Christian in a church in Kilwinnie. And he got converted by seeing this, because he saw the sacrificial nature of what the Christians were doing. Now, here's my question. When in SBC did we last have to do something sacrificially? He said they did it proportionally, then they did it sacrificially. And then he says they did it compulsively. He says their attitude was, we really want to do this. He said they begged with us in the NIV. We need to invest in what God is doing. And again, when was the last time that you had an earnest conversation with our treasurer or some organization that you're involved with and said, we really, really want to give to you? How can we give to you? How can we support you? How can we engage with you? You know, these were the attitudes. Their attitude was, we're going to give proportionately, we're going to sometimes do that sacrificially, and we're going to do that compulsively. We are desperate to give our money to the work of God and to invest in what God is doing. Now the question is, and I'm sure maybe some of you are all there this morning, but probably most of us aren't. The question is, how were they there? How were they in this place? And Paul tells us. He says, they did it in an unexpected way because we thought they were just going to give money. But he said, no, they didn't. They came and they committed themselves to God and then to the church. What he says is, they got themselves a vision of God and they then got themselves a vision of God's people. And it was that vision of God and the vision of God's people that drove their giving. Now listen to me. You see, if you all go out of this church and you all increase your giving after this series by, you know, 10% or whatever, actually, I failed. Well, maybe not in Ron's eyes. Why have I failed? Because what Paul is saying here is he's saying the issue of giving is not ultimately an issue about our money. It's ultimately an issue about our vision of God and our vision of his church. And if there's a resourcing issue, the issue is a theological issue. The issue is about how people see God, and the issue is about the church of God. You know, why are so many Christian churches struggling today? It's not because they're not convincing their members to give. Well, that's part of it. It's because the vision of God that they're presenting is such that it doesn't generate a desire for proportionate, sacrificial, and compulsive giving. Because people don't have a sense of God. The Bible tells us that we need to commit the first portion of our money to God. It says our vision of God should be such that we appreciate that God requires to be prioritized in our use of resources and our money. Listen to Proverbs 3, verses 9 through 10. Honor the Lord your God with your wealth and with the best part of everything your land produces. Then he will fill your barns with grain and your vats will overflow with the finest wine. I love this. And again, we'll see this actually as we go later on into 2 Corinthians. That actually, God invites us to test them in relation to this. He says, honor me with your resources and you will find something amazing in terms of what happens with your resources. This doesn't just go for your money, it goes for your time as well. Here's a weird thing, all right, and I invite you to test it out this week, okay, before you think about money. Just let's do it with your time. Give God the first part of your day. Give him half an hour at the start of your day. Get up and give him half an hour. You know, and you're all going, no, we're way too busy to do that. I'm saying, just carve it out. Do it. Give him the first half hour of your day. And then come back next week and tell me what your week looks like. Here's the weird thing. You start to give God priority in your time, suddenly the rest of your day starts to feel less busy. Test me on it. Go and do it. Okay, you can tell me if I'm wrong next week. You can all come by and say, Alistair, you're totally wrong. Because when you prioritize, God, the weird thing happens. Stuff starts to multiply. This stuff happens in terms of our resources. You see, what is happening in the Bible is it's saying we should prioritize God in terms of our times and our resources. Why? Because we are expressing, first of all, a gratitude for all that God has given to you, given to us. It's saying, God, I realize all this came from you. And if it wasn't for you, I wouldn't have any money anyway. So in gratitude, realizing it all comes from you, I give you the first and the best portion back. I can say I'm grateful, but if I don't give God the first and the best, I'm not grateful. I'm deceiving myself. So God needs to be prioritized as an expression of our gratitude. That's how you express gratitude. Secondly, it reflects priority. You see, it says, God, I want you to be number one in my life. So right off the top, the first part of my money goes back to you as a statement of priority, that you're number one in my life. You know, you can walk around and you can say God's number one and I worship God, but if I'm not giving him the first and the best, he's really not number one. Isn't that right? You know, I can say God's really important to me, his priorities are really important to me, and then you look at your bank statements and you say, where is this reflected? Or you can say, I'm really grateful to God. And they look at your bank statements and they say, where is this? A few years back, I was getting a mortgage, and it was under the new regs that were coming in. And so they required that you handed over all your bank statements for a few months. And I was really chuffed. I got a phone call from them. And they said to me, hey, we've just been going through your bank statements. And we want to know, what's all this money about here? And I went, that's my giving. And they were like, what do you mean? Explain this to me. And I go, that's the money I give away every month. And they went, oh, okay. But it was good that I got that phone call. Why? Because it actually reflected my priority and my gratitude. But lastly, it reflects faith. It's saying that we believe in God and we believe in a future. You see, God, you've made all these promises, and this is one of them, that you'll take care of me if I put you first in my money. So I'm going to give. I'm going to give the first and the best portion back to you in a statement of faith that I believe that you will take care of me in the future. See, here's the exciting thing, and again, for many of us, And as I say, most of us have resources and have a reasonable degree of prior affluence and security in relation to that. So very few of us ever stretch ourselves in terms of faith. Very few of us, and you know, I used to do it when I was in my 20s or when I was working for a faith organization. I would trust God in a situation. And if God didn't come through, I was really in trouble. And you know what happened? God always came through. The problem is now I'm 50 and I have a few more assets. I never find myself in that situation. And so I never have the wonder and the experience of seeing myself in a situation where if God doesn't come through, I'm really in trouble. And you know what happens? It gets hard to believe in God. See, belief in God, and this is the exciting thing, is not affirmed through arguments. It's not affirmed through theological notions. Belief in God is actually experienced as we do things and we see God come through. And God invites us to test us on this. Prioritize me, and then I'll come through for you. How did the church in Macedonia give proportionately, sacrificially, and compulsively, and do it with great joy and excitement? They did it because they had such a sense of their God, and they appreciated that they would express that through giving God their best to demonstrate their gratitude, their priority, and their sense of faith in who God was. What example are we giving in terms of the way that we give? Let's pray. Father God, I thank you for your word. And I thank you for the challenge of the example of the church in Macedonia. And Lord, we recognize that many of us have many issues in terms of money, that our issues of security, self-worth, identity are all tied up with money, and that for many of us, this is a very sensitive subject. But Lord, I pray that we would gain a fresh vision of you and a fresh vision of your church, and that out of that vision of you and that vision of your church, we would see patterns developing and examples given in the way that we regulate our material resources. Lord, I ask this in your name. Amen.